Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley and this is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. The show where we make conversations that matter happen on a regular basis. And if you're unfamiliar with what we do and you'd like to find out more, do check out the website where you can find today's programme, lots of others from the past, the podcast, features, articles, videos and much more besides. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. Links there, of course, to Unbelievable the Conference 2017 as well. Back and better than ever before. Saturday the 13th of May, you need to be at the Brewery in London, where I'm going to be joined by some brilliant Christian apologists and evangelists, including Professor John Lennox, returning after a five-year spell away from the Unbelievable Conference. He's a wonderful speaker, anecdotalist, and is going to be applying his enormous mind to our conference theme, which is Why Christ? Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything. So if you want to really get tooled up, this conference very much aimed at helping you to dialogue and talk to your non-Christian friends, skeptics, about why Christianity is the best explanation for life, the universe, and everything. I'm going to be launching my new book at the conference, telling you of why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. So that'll be your very first chance to get your hands on copies of that book. And looking forward to being joined by a multiplicity of other guests. Andy Bannister, Beth Grove, Dr. Jeremiah J. Johnston and Jerry Johnston join us again from the Christian Thinkers Society, our conference partner. And Museum of the Bible will be with us again as well. We're looking forward to seeing who comes over. But a number of others on the speaking roster. So go and check it out at the website. That's premier.org.uk/Why Christ. You can see some of the discount options, book two or more tickets. You'll get the last year's DVD for free. Again, we're doing that offer. And of course, still time to get the early bird rate as well. But that won't last forever. So I should book in now if you can. premier.org.uk/Why Christ. Okay, that's the conference. This is the show. Let me tell you what's coming up.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, do we need God to ground morality? Yes, we're debating the moral argument. It's the moral argument for God frequently crops up on Unbelievable in one form or another. But we haven't, for quite a long time, sat down to focus on the argument itself. It often takes the form of three premises if you're outlining the kind of philosophical argument. First premise, if God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. Second premise, but objective moral values do exist. Thirdly, therefore God exists. So I've got two people who are going to be debating this argument, and John Cranman, new to the show, is a Christian apologist. He works in video production at First Church of God, Vero Beach, Florida, and he's the co-host of the Riot in Reason podcast. Well, he's going to be presenting and defending his version of the moral argument for God today, and we'll be allowing him to set out exactly what those premises mean and what his particular way of phrasing them is and all that sort of thing. So if you're not following at this point what this moral argument is, how this, you know, is in any way evidence for God, John will set it out at the outset of the show. And the other person is Corey Markham. Corey's been on the show a few times now. He's a budding atheist philosopher. He's actually working on developing a new podcast called Hinge with another Christian show listener of Unbelievable, Drew Sokol. And Corey's recently written a response to the moral argument. He's going to be telling us why, whether or not these objective moral values exist, he doesn't think you can ground them in God. So welcome along to the programme, both John and Corey.
Hello.
Hello.
It's great to have you both with me, guys. John, let's come to you first. Welcome along to the programme. Have you been listening to Unbelievable for long, John?
Yeah, about 4 or 5 years. I love the show.
Fantastic. It's always great fun to have a show that's made up of people who are already familiar with the programme. And thank you for both you and Corey for reaching out for doing this particular subject today. Tell us a little bit about yourself, though, John. Did you grow up in a Christian family? How did you get involved in apologetics specifically?
It's really weird. I actually, as a youth, I grew up Jehovah's Witness. My family practiced that faith probably for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then we just kind of fell out. They stopped going. So for most of my teenage years, I didn't go to church at all. And then through a series of events, I kind of found my faith. And I became a Christian about age 22. And I would say getting into apologetics is something that happened around 2000, 2001. I was on an AOL chat room, and I ran into my first internet atheist, and he presented some arguments against my faith, and it kind of just drew me in. And I've just little by little over the years just kind of stumbled my way into this whole subculture. And you know, I'm a layperson. I haven't gone to school to study these things. I just read a lot. And I've tried to get better at this along the way. So,
well, look, you've got to the level where you get to go on Unbelievable. So, you know, John, no, I'm joking, because in a way,
I'm a little nervous.
I'm rather like you, John. I've felt my way along the line, you know, in apologetics. And I don't claim to be any great shakes as an apologist myself. But I think sometimes it's good when we get lay people together to talk about these things. We don't just have the sort of scholars and skeptics alone. But this Riot in Reason podcast, interestingly titled podcast, what's that about?
It's something my boss, I work at my church, and he is the multimedia pastor, and we were just talking one day, and it was kind of his idea. He just wanted to do a podcast, and he knew I was into apologetics, so it's him and I and a couple other guys, and I'm sort of the resident apologist, I guess you could say, and it's mostly, as far as tone, it's just kind of a lighthearted show.
Great.
We kind of banter, and then usually every episode we deal with a heavy topic, and most of the time it's in-house kind of topics, you know, what certain things Christians believe, and once in a while we'll get into apologetics and things like that. So, and we've been doing it for a few months now. So I think we started maybe late summer last year.
Well, I've got to confess, most churches here in the UK wouldn't have the resources for a multimedia pastor and a video resources sort of person like yourself. But great that your church is able to have that kind of facility and be reaching out in that way. John, welcome to the show anyway, and I'm looking forward to your interaction with Corey. Corey, welcome back to the program. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me again.
It's great to have you on again. Do you want to just tell us how your friendship and discussion and dialogue with John began?
Yeah, actually, it's similar to the way a lot of these relationships that I'm striking up are arising, and it really just had to do with Facebook. I'm not sure if I messaged him or he messaged me first, but I think we just sort of bumped into each other on there, and then kind of, as John said, he has a sort of a general interest in this and these apologetics and this sort of stuff, as I do. So we just kind of, hit it off, and I like to think that we're becoming pretty good friends, as far as, you know, Facebook friends go, being somewhat removed from each other. He's one of those, one of my Christian friends that I can actually sit there and talk to about some of these heavy issues, and neither one of us seems to get emotional, or at least not yet. We'll see how today goes.
I think I stalked Corey first because I heard him on Unbelievable, and he just struck me as the type of atheist you could take home to mom. So,
oh gosh,
yeah, he's one of my favorite atheists to talk with.
You should put that on your resume, Corey, the kind of atheist you can take home to mom.
I'm blushing over here.
Corey, tell us a little bit about Hinge, because this is something we've been in communication over. Exciting new project that you're working on with another show listener, Drew Sokol. Just give us the brief story about Hinge and what we can expect to see in the future.
Sure. So about a year and a half ago, and actually I was just talking about meeting people through Facebook, so this is a perfect example. I actually got a message from a pastor that was located out in L.A., and he was starting up a podcast that was somewhat loosely going to be about the historical figure Jesus Christ and sort of the impact that his life especially the actions of his followers had on Western civilization. And, you know, initially we were just sort of talking back and forth and exchanging ideas. And similar to John, he had heard me on your show, Justin. So a lot of awesomeness is coming through your show. But you know, eventually he asked me, you know, he's like, would you want to be the co-host for this show that I'm developing? And I was like, well, of course I do. Like, that would be awesome. And actually, you know, about 5 months ago, there was a kind of a change, pretty radical change in my life in terms of what I was doing. It freed me up and made it possible for me to actually move out to Philadelphia. Where Drew Sokol, my co-host of the podcast, where he lives, him and his wife. And so I actually moved out here just a week or so ago, and I'm currently doing this full time with Drew. Right now we're in the very, you know, the initial development stage. We're reaching out for interviews and getting people, getting the recordings and whatnot. And we actually have, I forgive me for plugging myself here, but we actually have a making of podcast that you can go and download on iTunes now. It's sort of like the behind the scenes look at what we're doing and the topics we're going to talk about. Yeah.
So, well, look, I'll make sure to post a link with today's program to what you've got so far with Hinge.
Awesome.
And I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. It sounds like a great idea. And I'm so pleased that Unbelievable, in ways completely, you know, unbeknown to me, is catalyzing these kinds of creative ventures in other areas. So that's fantastic as far as I'm concerned. But let's get into what we're talking about on the program today, guys. We're talking about the moral argument. And if you're listening and you'd like to contribute feedback, voice your objection or support for either of what my guests have to say today, don't forget you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Of course, you can also get in touch via the social media at UnbelievableJB to follow on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All of those links and more, plus you can comment there as well on the page on our website where you can find today's show. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So the question we're asking on Unbelievable today is, do we need God to ground morality? The moral argument for God frequently crops up on the programme, but today we're really looking at it. We're drilling down on it in a bit of depth. And what we're going to do with my guests, John Cranman and Corey Markham, John, our Christian, Corey, our atheist, is look at that, look at what Corey's objections are to it, and try and get as far as we can in other respects as well, asking, do objective moral values exist? Or what is there evidence for them? And what about other ways of trying to get to some kind of objective morality that doesn't require some kind of transcendent being to ground it and so on? So lots that we're going to be trying to cover in the program today. But why don't we start off with you, John, maybe just setting out your stall. And for those maybe who really don't know what the moral argument is for God, just explain what it is and how you would put it forward and how you think it works.
Sure. I wanted to kind of preface and just let everybody know, you know, I'm a lay person. So if I butcher some of this, forgive me. I'm still trying to learn. So I'm just going to do my best here. And this should apply for the entire content of today's show. Anyways, the moral argument basically is we're looking at phenomena we see, just a moral reality that most of us experience. And we're trying to make the best sense of it. And my job or my opinion is that this phenomena best points to a transcendent source, God. So I can kind of I'll present my version of the argument. Ultimately, when you start scratching the surface, it comes off very similar to what William Lane Craig offers. I just word it a little differently, a little softer. So, here's my argument. Premise one, if objective moral values and duties exist, God is the best explanation. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. And conclusion, God is the best explanation. And I should probably define my terms here just to make sure everybody, we're all on the same page and listeners kind of understand what I mean. When I say objective morality, I'm referring to the idea that there really are right or wrong actions, regardless of opinion or condition. And by condition, I mean certain goals you're trying to achieve. You know, these things are right or wrong, regardless of the goals you're trying to achieve or the opinions you have on the matter. And by moral values, I'm just referring to some sort of standard of right and wrong. For example, loving your neighbor is good. Injustice is wrong. Those are kind of standards of right and wrong. Moral duties would be things that you are morally obligated to do, such as don't steal from the elderly and taking care of your family. Those are things that you're morally obligated to do.
And these are things that you would say are objectively true, these moral values and duties. So yes. Injustice is wrong. That's true, whether or not someone else happens to believe it, whatever place and time you happen to live in, that would still be true. Even if everyone disagreed with it, it would still be true.
Yes.
Okay. What kind of, for you, makes you, enables you to say that is objectively true? Is that just something you perceive in some way that you know, doesn't need to be kind of explained or logically spelled out?
Yeah, I can get into that in a sec. Can I defend the first premise
for
a little bit?
Go for
and then
it,
we
yeah.
can kind of
we'll
get into
we'll
that.
We'll get back into that.
My first premise here, obviously this implies, you know, God is the best explanation for this phenomena. And what that implies is that this probably isn't compatible with atheism. So one of the reasons I would say that is that if an atheist posits the type of universe where nothing was created for any purpose, any goal, or any reason, I think if you try to incorporate a moral system where there is a goal, there's kind of target behavior, there's an ought, and there's normativity, I think you're going to run into a contradiction. You can't at one point say there is no way things ought to be, and then incorporate an ethical system where there is a way that humans ought to behave. So I think from the start, it seems like there's a self-contradiction if you're going to claim reality is this way and then try to incorporate this ethical system that seems to deny what you just claimed. So I don't think it's compatible with atheism. So that kind of, let me just rewind real quick. I think objective morality itself is the sort of thing, it represents an ideal, a way we ought to be, like a target behavior. And that seems to imply a goal. There's this ideal behavior that we all should attain. So I just don't think that's compatible with atheism.
Because atheism, as you understand...
So maybe I can pause there.
And just to kind of make this clear, the reason it's not compatible with atheism, the idea that there is an oughtness about the things we do, is that as far as you can see, in a world without God... And I don't know whether what you really have in mind is a kind of a naturalistic worldview in which all that really exists is matter in motion, that there's no reason why we should have, why there would be an oughtness about anything. Things just are. There's nothing that exists beyond that. Is that kind of where you're coming from on this, John?
Yeah, especially a universe that doesn't have us in mind. Why? Mm-hmm. How would... You know, 200,000 years ago in a universe that's 14.7 billion years old, how all of a sudden would this oughtness arise that applies to all humans? I think there's, it just seems very improbable and almost self-contradictory. And in philosophy, if a concept is self-contradictory, it's pretty much toast. I'm not sure how those two can be compatible. Unless you redefine naturalism in kind of a a different way where it doesn't rule out telos or purpose or, but that would be very, that'd be an odd sort of metaphysic, I think.
Well, look, we'll come back later on in the program to premise two, which is your statement that objective moral values and duties do exist, because that's often something that, you know, a skeptic and atheist will contest anyway. But the thing we're really going to focus on first of all is that first premise that only that God is the best explanation of the existence of objective moral values and duties, and atheism isn't. So trying to switch over to you, Corey, at this point, because this is where mainly your objection lies to the moral argument, as I understand it. So first of all, are you happy with kind of the way John has set out the argument, and what's your response?
Yeah, well, so first let me make two preliminary remarks and see if John is okay with those. So first, I think, strictly speaking, in order for John to make his case fully, he would need to show that each, or at least a significant percentage of the respective secular moral systems of moral realism, he would need to show that they're all explanatorily deficient in comparison to his particular, or perhaps other versions of God-centered morality. Now, obviously, this is impossible in the allotted time we have. He can't meet that standard today in this conversation. But I think it's worth pointing out all the same, you know, that even if John managed to just completely wipe the floor with me in this discussion, and hey, maybe he probably will, seems like a smart guy. You know, even then, that this more conservative, abductive version of the moral argument would still have a long way to go before it could be considered exhaustive. And then my second remark, I suppose, would be it's also worth noting, of course, that, you know, insofar as this is an argument for the existence of God, it's possible for the atheist to simply affirm moral non-realism, as I tend to do, and outright deny the second premise of the moral argument, thereby rendering the entire argument moot. To persuade these atheists, John and theists like him, running this and other moral arguments, would have to, in that case, they would have to not only defend the first premise, again, which is what the bulk of our conversation is going to be about, but they would also have to demonstrate that moral realism actually is true in the first place, that moral facts exist.
Let me just
say that for the sake of discussion, yeah. I'm just going to grant the second premise of John's argument so we can hone in on the first one. But for everyone knows, I'm not convinced that moral realism is true.
Well, if we get time, we'll try and get to moral realism later on. But as you say, for the sake of argument, let's grant that, and let's talk about whether God can ground this supposed moral realism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that, are those 2 points fair? I think, I mean, nothing crazy, I'm saying.
No, absolutely. 100% agree. And even if, like we've talked on the side too, and I've read your paper, even if atheism does entail kind of a broad moral nihilism, that doesn't automatically point to God. And I kind of want to go into the second part of my defense. Well, how does all this point to God?
Yeah.
So, exactly. Like I said, can I go into that, or
well,
is that okay?
Let me go ahead. And,
yeah,
yeah. Okay, John.
Corey was just giving
hold on
a, giving
hold
a few.
Hold on to your horses, there, bud.
Okay, Corey, but take us into what your main problem is then with the first premise here of John's argument.
Sure. So, as John said, he wrote my paper. So I have my recent blog article is on this topic. So if anyone wants to check it out and get more in depth into what I'm saying here, they can. So John is familiar with everything I'm going to say here. The first thing, just real quick, I think the initial problem with grounding morality, and this is just sort of an interesting thing to point out, I think, is that it doesn't seem to provide moral obligations for atheists. Now, what I mean by that is I think most people would take it as a maxim and would think that's just necessarily the case that in order for someone to be obligated to do something, they must regard the issuer of that obligation as a competent authority. In other words, you know, if a cop tells me here in America, the cop tells me to pull over to the side of the road, insofar that I recognize that cop is a competent authority, then I'm going to obey that command, right? But if a random person said that I'm not going to, and arguably I shouldn't have to obey that authority. There's no reason to. Now, consider this little point in the context of this debate. So suppose, like, I'm an atheist, right? Suppose that I'm wrong about atheism, that God does exist. But suppose that I'm genuinely an atheist and that I'm not choosing to not believe in God. It's just a matter of belief. I, you know, this is just the way I see things. It doesn't seem reasonable for me to expect an atheist to recognize the moral obligations of a God that it doesn't believe in. And if that's the case, then that seems to suggest that whether or not theism is true, atheists, you know, they still wouldn't have obligations on theism. And so that's not my main objection at all, but I at least wanted to hear what John thought about that, because I think it's kind of an interesting thing to point out here. God doesn't seem to help atheists in this realm.
Do you want to respond to that before we get to Corey's main point?
I would say at best that would call into question whether you're morally obligated to God per se, like his commands. But yeah. I think even Christian theism kind of grants that there are there's a bit of morality that's already been revealed to you. And I think you're obligated for those sorts of things, you know, just to be kind to your neighbor, not to act unjustly, those sorts of things. I think most of us kind of agree on that, you know. I wanted to kind of go back really quick just to get this in here before we move on. As far as debunking every naturalistic account of moral realism, I think so long as any of those naturalistic accounts entails a universe where there is no oughtness and it tries to incorporate an ethical system where there is this sort of oughtness, this normativity that applies to everybody regardless of opinion, I think you're going to have a contradiction. Whether or not I per se actually read and address and go through all the minutiae of that argument, I think so long as those two things are trying to be put together, there's going to be a contradiction. So unless there's a naturalistic account that doesn't incorporate that sort of reality. So I just wanted to say that.
Sure. I should, just to clarify, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but and I know, John, that you realize this, but on atheism, that, you know, moral realism, there are basically two options. One would be sort of the naturalistic version of moral realism on atheism, and the other would be non-naturalistic moral realism on atheism. And that would, you know, and so we'll get into that, but it's not at all the case, or it's not obviously the case, at least, that the atheist, if they're going to take moral realism stance, that they have to do so in a way that, you know, that's naturalistic. But that said, you know, that's fine. Like you said, we're going to get into the weeds more realism here. Yeah. Hopefully, at the end of the conversation. So, yeah. Okay. Well, let me just jump into my primary objection.
Before you do that, Corey, because we're already approaching the end of the first section, and we haven't even got to your central objection. So, why don't we just take a break a little bit early, and then we'll have more time for you to actually spell out your main objection to the moral argument. So we'll come back in a short moment's time. Corey Markham and John Cranman, my guests on today's edition of Unbelievable, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Something of a philosophical edition of the programme, kind of like we had last week, actually, when we had Frank Turek and David Smalley debating whether atheists are stealing logic and reason from God. Well, this is a different argument for God, the moral argument for God. And we've heard it expounded by John, our Christian guest. Corey Markham is going to be delivering what he thinks is the major problem for him with the moral argument in just a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking and brings you conversations that matter. Unbelievable. See you in a short moment.
How can I know it's true?
What about other religions?
Why Christ? Join me, Justin Brierley, to find answers at Unbelievable The Conference 2017. Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything, and how to share him with others. Plus, I'll be launching my new book and sharing why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists. It's in London on Saturday the 13th of May with great speakers, including Professor John Lennox, Beth Grove, Andy Bannister, and Jeremiah J. Johnston of our conference partner, the Christian Thinkers Society. Early bird tickets are available now at premier.org.uk/whychrist.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show, Unbelievable. With me, Justin Brierley, is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Sometimes it's, you know, at a fairly lay level. Today's, though, is a bit more technical, a bit more of a philosophical debate going on between my Christian and atheist guest, John Cranman, and Corey Markham. Be introducing them again in a moment's time. Don't forget that the profile is here a little later on today. You can actually hear me on conversation on part of today's profile with none other than N.T. Wright. He's a well-known biblical scholar, and you'll be interested to hear what he had to say to me about his latest book, The Day the Revolution Began, which, of course, we featured him talking about on Unbelievable last year as well. But you'll also get a little insight into the man himself. That's straight after today's programme, between 4 and 5 on The Profile. Don't forget that some of your feedback as well before we get there. We'll be hearing what you had to say in regards to that show of last week when I was joined by Christian apologist Frank Turek and atheist talk show host David Smalley. But my two guests on Unbelievable today are John Cranman and Corey Markham. John Cranman, a Christian apologist, works in video production at First Church of God, Vero Beach, Florida, co-host of the Riot in Reason podcast, but today presenting and defending the moral argument for God, the idea that God is the best explanation of objective moral values and duties, the kinds of things which are always true, morally speaking, regardless of situation, context, time, and everything else, and that all people are therefore obligated to follow. And if those do exist, then God exists. Well, Corey Markham has already voiced a couple of issues that he has with that particular idea, that way of reasoning to God. He's a atheist philosopher. He's developing a new podcast himself called Hinge, which he is going to be the co-host of. But most recently, he's written a response to the moral argument. So coming back to you then, Corey, this is where we get into the meat of your problem with this argument. We've spelled out the first, second and third premises. And it's really the first that we're dealing with here. This idea that God is the best explanation of objective moral values and duties. So do you want to leap into why for you that just doesn't make sense?
Yeah. So to do so, I have to start with Plato. So let's rewind. Okay. Let's rewind time. Go back. So like 428 to 347 BCE is when Plato lived. Or if you guys prefer BC, BC. Okay, I'll be charitable. Plato wrote 36 dialogues, so called because they're written in the form of dialogues or conversations between his teacher and mentor Socrates and then other people, or at least all of them but one take this form. One of the earliest and most influential dialogues is the Euthyphro, named after one of the key characters. In this dialogue, Socrates comes upon Euthyphro, and they begin to discuss morality and ultimately whether or not the younger Euthyphro has a firm grasp on the nature of moral truth. Eventually, Socrates presents him with what is now known as the Euthyphro Dilemma, which I think we can sort of translate to our modern parlance like this. Is something moral because God commands it? Or does God command something because it is moral? Put in another way, perhaps, is rape wrong because God commands us not to rape? Or does God command us not to rape because rape is wrong? So consider the first option. I guess you could just bite the bullet and you could say that rape is only wrong if God says it's wrong. But this seems to make morality arbitrary, as it, you know, it would ultimately just be determined by a divine fiat. And it also seems to entail that nothing is intrinsically good or bad, right or wrong. And therefore, at least in principle, anything could be considered or made right or wrong. So think like Abraham sacrificing his son. Under this theory of morality, if he would have gone through with it and actually killed his son, had the angel not come down in the last moment, that would have been the right and moral thing to do. Similarly, there are I won't call it genocide because I know that's controversial, but there in the very least, there seems to be examples of divinely sanctioned ethnic cleansing in certain parts of scripture. This too, under this theory of morality, they would be perfectly moral and good. Even if they're killing babies, it doesn't matter. What God commands is what's good. So that's one option. The second option is to say that, you know, God commands us not to rape because rape is wrong. This I would argue. To most people, certainly, and just if you were to ask them answer at face value, it seems to be the most common sense or intuitive thing, because basically, you know, God notices or takes note of the fact that things are wrong and he commands accordingly, sort of a way to put it. But then you might see the problem with this already from the theist perspective, you know, because it seems to undermine sort of the basic tenet behind the moral argument, because it suggests that whatever morality is, it seems to exist independently from God. So Okay, so that is divine command theory, essentially, or that is rather that's the Euthyphro dilemma. And the first option there is sort of what we refer to as divine command theory. It's the theory of morality that goodness, right, and all that is determined by God's commands. Now that I think, for obvious reasons, isn't the most popular view among Christians, and has been unpopular for a long time, arguably since Plato first brought up this problem. And so theists, as they're wont to do, they've found ways to get around it. And so a way to get around it, I like to call this the second view. It's modified divine command theory. There are other words, there are other names for it, like divine attribute theory is another one. And this, I think, is essentially what John's view is. And basically, the idea here is that rather than God's commands being the ground for moral goodness and for moral obligations, it's more like God's nature is sort of the standard by which we can measure whether or not something's good or bad. And then his commands are still important, right? So his commands do give us moral obligations, but those commands that he makes, along with all of his other actions, are determined or constrained by his good nature. So in other words, this seems to avoid the dilemma that the Euthyphro dilemma is originally pointing out, because it's not so much that God can just command whatever and make that to be right or wrong. You know, he can't do that. He can't just say, oh, well, you should go rape this person and that's right, because that would conflict with his perfectly good nature. But at the same time, it also seems to avoid the second aspect of the dilemma, because it doesn't seem here that morality is independent. Again, at least not at face value, because it's sort of goodness is sort of contained in God's nature, if you will.
Yeah.
I went through a lot there, and I should say anyone who really is interested in this stuff, obviously you're gonna have to go into far more detail here. But John, just real quick before I actually lay out my objection to your view, is that fair, what I've said so far, sort of about the traditional view of morality and God?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I'm tracking with you. So
yeah, and I'm tracking.
Okay, awesome.
As well.
Right.
So far you've laid out the problem, the Euthyphro dilemma. Is are things good because God commands them, or does God command them because they're good? Both of them seem to make things either God a bit pointless, or God a bit arbitrary in terms of what he commands. You've said, okay, people try to answer this from a theistic perspective by saying, well, God is the good. It's the nature of God which grounds the moral things that he then commands. So what's your problem with this? Why is that?
So basically, I think that all this does is push the goalpost back a bit.
Uh-huh.
In other words, I think that there's another Euthyphro, we might say it's a Euthyphro-like dilemma, to borrow language from Wes Morrison and some of the other philosophers working on this area. But it seems to create another dilemma in that, in this case, the dilemma sort of goes like this. A great way to put this is to imagine or think of the ways we typically would describe God, right? So God is perfectly honest. He's impartial. He's compassionate, and so on. The question this new dilemma teases out is something like honesty good because God is honest, because he has that trait, right? Or does God have that trait? Is God honest because being honest is good? So there's a subtle difference here, granted, and it's sort of hard to understand at first value, but look at it like this. You know, on the one hand, let's see. So on the one hand, if honesty is good because God is honest, mm-hmm. right? Then again, there doesn't seem to be anything intrinsically good about being honest, right? It's just sort of like honesty is good because God is honest, and mm-hmm. if God was dishonest, well, dishonesty or lying would be good.
Okay.
I hesitate using the really fancy philosophical jargon here, but there's a term that's referred to as the featureless property objection. And basically what that means is that if we're saying that, it's almost like we're saying that God is good, like his goodness is logically prior to things like honesty and compassion and impartiality. And if that's the case, then that seems to strip goodness from any of the features that we normally utilize or use when making sense of goodness, right? So again, it's like The problem is that I would argue that this, in order to make the case that John Winston making, he has to use the word goodness in a way that is incoherent and doesn't even jive with his own moral intuitions.
Yeah,
because it's not that it's not God isn't good because he's honest and impartial and just and all these different things. Like that's not the right way to look at it, you know.
Okay.
That's the basic problem here is that there's a new dilemma that's created. Rather than it just being arbitrary or, you know, or independent in the first sense, you know, it's arbitrary or it completely gets rid of this, or excuse me, it's independent or just it makes goodness just incoherent.
Yeah. Well, okay. So it's a bit like the atheist who responds to the idea that, well, God created the universe, and the atheist says, well, who created God then? It's kind of the equivalent for the moral argument saying, okay, grounding the good in God sort of gets you out of the horns of the Euthyphro dilemma, but hey, just shifts the problem back one bit. What about God, the goodness of God himself? You know, is that then susceptible to a Euthyphro dilemma style problem? Thank you very much. You obviously had to take a little bit of time to outlay that, but you did it very well, I thought, Corey. Thank you. All right, John, where do you begin on this? And we'll try and bat this between you for a little while now.
Sure. Let me just rewind. I want to say I agree with Corey 100% on his objections. I still don't think it creates the problem he thinks it creates. But I wanted to rewind real quick just to illustrate briefly how I think God is the best explanation for this morality. So if we rewind, we find this phenomena, this objective morality, and it kind of creates this ought. So we have an ought in the reality we exist in. And we have to make sense of it. And I think God makes sense of this ought because he creates the universe, and the universe starts with an ought, including the human beings. So all these qualities we usually associate with the good, like being loving, just, kind, etc. Plausibly, when God creates the universe, he creates all humans to display those sorts of qualities. So there's an ought. And it just makes sense in a universe that's created with an ought. Okay, so I wanted to get that out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what Corey just laid out, I agree. I think the first Euthyphro can be evaded, but now we're kind of trying to make sense of God's nature. Well, why is God's nature good? And usually what we do is we have this set of qualities that we think are good, and typically, the theistic response is that God makes those sorts of qualities good, like love, kindness, justice. And so we're trying to account for the goodness of those qualities and the goodness of God's nature. And I concede Corey's second Euthyphro. I honestly, at this point, I don't see how God's existence per se makes these qualities good. I would agree with Corey. I think these qualities are inherently good, and I think that those qualities are what make God good. But what Corey would probably say is, aha, so you don't need God.
Mm-hmm.
QED, argument's over. And
you
what
read
I
my
would
mind.
Say, yeah, what I know you too well. I read your paper for the last 4 or 5 months, so, and I've come to a lot of the same conclusions. However, what I would want to say, the reason I don't think this is a problem, is because these qualities, if all of us in the room here, kind of we think these things are the good, you know, in capital letters. Qualities like love, justice, kindness, those things don't exist in a vacuum or by themselves. Those are the kinds of things that are properties of persons. Like, persons are loving, they're just, they're kind. So anytime the qualities that we normally call the good, quote unquote, if they are ever manifested in reality, they're always in the form of a person. So I would say these qualities God grounds them in the sense not that he makes them good. He grounds them in the sense that he's the source of those things. Those things are embodied by persons, and he's the archetype, the original person with a capital P that exudes those sorts of qualities. So God doesn't make those qualities good per se, but he's the source of the good in that sense. So
there's a sense in which what you're saying is you can't really speak of moral values and duties outside of a moral agent that is in some way giving them out or responding to them or doing things with them. And in that sense, at an ultimate level, they can't exist in a sort of a purely materialistic universe where they have to be grounded in some kind of an agent. And for you, obviously, God is the one that yeah. it makes sense to ground
it
in.
Those properties they're manifested by persons. When you see them manifested in reality, they're through persons. So they don't exist apart from persons, because persons are loving, persons are just, they're kind. So I think those kinds of qualities yeah. have to exist embodied in some sort of person. The good is it always can be found in a person, not independently like okay. this abstract object, which just seems very unintelligible.
Okay, so thank you very much, John. Corey, so there you go. That's the answer to your dilemma. Case closed. I guess we can all put that.
Well, I'm convinced. I mean, I think we're done here.
I mean, I didn't think it would be that simple somehow, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, this is really interesting because I guess it just has to do with we just sort of disagree about what the implications of this modified Euthyphro dilemma is or are. And essentially, it seems to me that if we established already that you know that there's something intrinsically good about certain properties, about certain qualities, then whether or not God exists, a person can be good insofar that they fulfill or, you know, carry out those properties, or insofar that they behave in that way. So, for instance, I mean, again, what we're saying is that the reason why God is good, granted, he's perfectly good, so I'm not claiming that I can be perfectly good, right? But what we're claiming is that the reason that God is good is because he's honest and impartial and all this stuff. Well, I don't see why that I can't, therefore, say something similar in that, you know, insofar that I behave in an honest way, in an impartial way, in a compassionate way, well, then that's good. And this issue with where these moral values are, like in the world or in the universe, I think is sort of it comes from a categorical error in reasoning. And namely, these things like moral values are by definition, by their very nature, are not the sort of things that exist in the universe, like a chair, say, or like an atom. It's like the number three. You can't find the number three anywhere. Like, good luck. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that three doesn't exist in the sense that we typically use it in the abstract sense. And so, you know, these values are definitely abstract. I'm not denying that. But, you know, that doesn't seem to be an issue in itself. You know, I think it just seems to be sort of the way Christians commonly think about this is this way, that they exist in the universe as a part of the furniture of the universe, if you will. And so that natural way of thinking just sort of lends them to this error, I think. It's interesting because in a sense, it seems like John is sort of trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Okay.
And I don't really think that's the case because John's a smart guy.
Okay. John?
I was actually going to say the same thing about you.
Oh, no.
Because if I can just rejoin real quick, that contradiction I highlighted earlier is going to be present. If you think this means that you don't need God, so basically you're granting there's this ought in the universe, so we have these qualities like love, kindness, justice. If you grant that, this is the good, we don't need God, this implies, okay, there's this ought, we all ought to behave this way. So let's say we wipe the slate clean, we get rid of God. So you're back to that contradiction I highlighted. So we have this universe where there's no purpose, no goal, no oughtness, and now you're trying to keep the ought without God. I think that contradiction kind of it makes toast of that position. You have the only way to retain that ought, you have to have a universe that begins with an ought. That's the only way to make sense of it. So you're kind of you can't incorporate that ought into a naturalistic universe. The only way you can incorporate that ought is in a universe that begins with an ought. So you're kind of, you know, hello theism. You know what I'm saying?
Well, so John, insofar that I understand your concern here, it seems to be sort of the thing that Hume is famous for having brought up, right? This deriving an ought from an is, fallacy. It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that you're doing the same thing, that you also are deriving an ought from an is. And what I mean by that is your ought, obviously, you know, is the obligations and whatnot that we have on us, but that ought is coming from an is, that is being God. God is perfectly good, you know, like just the fact that God exists, like that's an is statement. Mm-hmm. And so, like, insofar that that's the issue, in other words, that you're worried about driving an ought from an is, well, then both of us are doing that. And that, you know, I don't really see this. So insofar that it's a problem, therefore, that it applies to both of us and or to you and the atheist, rather. Because, again, actually, strictly speaking, I'm actually not trying to drive an ought from is. It's part of my problem with affirming moral realism, because I think that's a real problem that God doesn't get us out of. So. Would you agree that you're driving off Miz and you just think that it's justified in your case, or am I dead wrong there?
I don't think I'm driving an ought from it is. I think there really is an ought in the sense that we have these qualities, you know, like love, justice, kindness. Those qualities exist in God, and God creates all creatures in his image to reflect the same qualities that he displays. So all creatures ought to display those qualities since he created them that way. So there's a fact.
Yeah, but that second that part though, I mean, that would be an is statement. Like, part of the problem here is that, like, people can make is statements without using the word is, right? Because we're losing sight of the point if we're just focusing on the word is. Like, the point is that we're making this ought, this move from something being the case, like God existing, God being perfectly good, to therefore you ought to do X. And I should also say that I think both Hume's fallacy, the is from the ought from is fallacy, and G.E. Moore's open question, I mean, those both apply to this question of God, because like the G.E. Moore's open question is basically it's what you do is you ask. Whether, so let's say we identify goodness with well-being, like Sam Harris. G. Moore's open question objection basically says that it's perfectly reasonable for a person to still ask at that point, what is goodness? Because, you know, like it's not obvious, it's not self-evident that goodness should be identified with well-being. But G. Moore, you know, that people tend to think that's just referring to views on morality and naturalism, but that applies to supernaturalism too. The same question arises if we try to identify goodness with God's nature, say, because it still makes sense to ask whether or not that's still goodness. And to John or someone like William and Craig, they'd be like, "Well, of course it does. So that's what it means. It's obvious, but it's not obvious." You know, there's this undeniable layer of subjectivity here. We're all sort of just sort of weighing what seems plausible to us, and that again sort of points back to why I don't see that's why I don't affirm moral realism, because there's just an undeniable subjective layer to this.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from with that, Corey. Any response, John, before we start to head towards our
yes,
second?
Yes, I think you're asking a different question than I'm answering. I already kind of granted earlier. I think what you're asking is, well, why are these qualities good? And I've already granted that I think I see them as good in a primitive sense. There's nothing else I can appeal to. And that's not what I'm responding to, though. I'm saying that it still seems to be the fact that, you know, whether or not I can explain why these things are good doesn't mean that there is no ought that applies to all human beings. I still think that's still the case. Whether you agree or not that those things are good, all humans under theism ought to display those qualities that we usually associate with the good. I still think theism has that additional fact that atheism doesn't offer. Now, atheism can, you know, just kind of appeal to some sort of ethics in a primitive way, and that's it. But there's no additional fact in reality that all humans ought to achieve that end. But at least on theism, you still have that, you know, all humans ought to display these qualities, whether or not you can account for why those qualities are good. I still think there's more weight on the theistic side to our experience and our intuitions. So
I guess it's kind of it's encapsulated in the way you form the moral argument, which is a little bit looser than God exists. It's the best. God is the best explanation for these things, which kind of, I guess, gives you a little bit of more wiggle room, John, in that sense, in that you're saying
that it's not a coincidence.
It's a better explanation than atheism.
I'm trying to just be in line with my intuitions as best as I can. And, you know, if that means there's some murky areas, I want to be fair to the skeptics. So I kind of, you know, it's not to be slick. That's not why I worded it this way. I think the intuitions call for it to be worded this way. And I want to say I disagree with William Lane Craig on how God accounts for goodness, and also William Alston. I differ from them on that. I don't think God makes those properties good.
Okay. We've got to another break already, but I'm glad that we've got some really substantive discussion under our belt. And when we come back, we'll aim to maybe talk a little bit about the second premise as well, which is moral realism itself. You know, do objective moral values exist? Why would John think they do? And why obviously would just Corey think actually they don't anyway? So we'll get to that, and hope you can join us in just a short moment's time as we continue this discussion today on the moral argument for God. Deliver us from evil. In the February edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we open up the real-life world of exorcism and deliverance ministry, separating fact from the Hollywood fiction of demonic possession. We also talk to the world's most influential Bible scholar, N.T. Wright, on why he's returning to the revolutionary cross of Christ. You'll learn about the six lies our worship music tells us and how we can fix them. And we'll hear from the family law court judge delivering his evidence on why we need to save marriage for the good of the UK. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to Unbelievable. This is the programme where Christians and non-Christians get together for dialogue and debate every Saturday afternoon here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Briley, and as well as bringing you Unbelievable, I'm the editor of Premier Christianity magazine. Our February edition is in shops. It is on doormats, and it's available to you free if you're not a subscriber but would like to ask for a free sample copy. A really interesting debate and discussion on the existence of the demonic on the front cover. Exorcism, the real life world of exorcism is what we're covering. Be fascinating to get back to that actually at some point in an edition of Unbelievable. But if you fancy getting hold of a copy of the latest edition of the mag, go to premierchristianity.com. You'll see there an interview that I had recently with N.T. Wright, probably the most influential Bible scholar on the planet. And you can also listen to me talking to N.T. Wright after today's programme as well. That's on the profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon. But again, if you want to get a free sample copy of the mag, premierchristianity.com/freesample. Just a reminder as well, if you want to listen back to today's programme, find more resources, interviews, features, and of course links to this year's Unbelievable Conference happening Saturday the 13th of May. Why Christ? How Jesus is the answer to life, the universe and everything. It's a big claim, but it's a big faith that we proclaim as Christians. Then you're welcome to go and check that out at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. If you want to just go straight to the website for the conference this year, premier.org.uk/whyChrist is the place to go. We'll be hearing some of your feedback as well to last week's show towards the end of today's programme. And if you can come back next week for Unbelievable, fascinating discussion on a recent event that took place at the Royal Society in November last year. It was a conference on a third way in biology. Is the neo-Darwinian paradigm dead and done? That was kind of being debated in various ways by biologists at the Royal Society in London last year. And a number of people with an interest in that were there as well, including Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute, who's well known as an intelligent design theorist, as well as a friend of the show, Perry Marshall, who's got his own view on how this all works and how it ties into faith in God. Well, we're going to be debating what happened to evolution at the Royal Society on next week's programme. Stephen Meyer and Perry Marshall are going to be joining me for that. So if you're interested in those kinds of issues, you'll want to come back for that program. Right now, though, we're talking about the moral argument for God.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And today on the programme, I've been joined by Corey Markham and John Cranman. Corey, a budding atheist philosopher. He's developing a new podcast called Hinge. I'll make sure there's links to that from today's show. He's recently written a response to the moral argument for God, and that was laid out at the top of the programme for us by John Cranman, our Christian guest on the programme today. And we've heard a really substantive dialogue between them, both friends, both interested in debating these philosophical issues. But ultimately, Corey's position comes down to the idea that God doesn't really help you ground these supposed moral values, and we heard John responding in kind. We want to talk about the second premise of the moral argument, the idea that objective moral values and duties do exist. We kind of assumed that for the purpose of debating the first premise earlier on in the show, but we're going to talk about whether there is this sort of moral realm, this moral realism, as people call it. Corey, be interested just starting out. What do you make of people who do claim to have converted, or at least converted to some form of theism, if not Christianity, because of the claims of the moral argument? I'm thinking of people like C.S. Lewis. He famously wrote, of course, I think it was in Mere Christianity, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust, but how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust?" Which I think quite neatly encapsulates the idea at the heart of the moral argument, that people often, you know, tend to say, oh, this is not fair. And then you are asked, well, in what sense can you speak of fairness in a world where such things are just an illusion at the end of the day? And a more recent example would be Leo Labresco, who had a similar journey to Lewis as an atheist blogger, who said it was really the moral argument that tipped her towards believing there really is a God who grounds these kind of moral facts that we unearthed. She described it as, like, rather than inventing things like an architect, we discover moral truth like an archaeologist. What do you think of people who do claim to have this has been the defining argument that has brought them to faith, Corey?
First, you have to be convinced of two things, I think, in order for that to happen. One, you have to be convinced that objective moral values exist, and two, that objective moral values can only exist if God exists. Like, note that these are actually two separate positions that are all often conflated and confused and in this sort of conversation, especially just in the in debates and in formats like this, because frankly there's just not enough time to really get into it. So you have to already think that objective moral values exist, and then you have to also be convinced that there's some, like, necessary relation between God's existence and the existence of moral values. So, like, on one, as I already said, I'm not a moral non-realist, so this just isn't helpful for me. This isn't, by the way, for the lack of trying. I want to clarify. I mean, you should see the stuff I read for fun. One of the books I'm reading right now is Eric Willenberg's book on what he calls non-natural, non-theistic, normative realism. And in truth, you could write a book about each one of those little qualifiers. But suffice it to say that I'm actively trying to be convinced of the truth of moral realism, but it just hasn't happened yet. Doesn't mean I'm happy about it. You know, again, I would rather be the case that moral realism is true. Nor does this mean that I can't make. I want to really make this point clear. It doesn't mean that I can't make objective evaluations relative to certain standards. So insofar that I value well-being, for instance, and do not value needless suffering, then there are actions that I either should or should not do. And that's objectively the case. And if I live in a country with laws and it's a factual objective matter, for instance, as to whether or not I break those laws, if I live in a country with laws, it's a factual objective matter as to whether or not I break those laws.
Sure.
My concern is the deeper concern, obviously, right? Like whether or not there's something deeper. And then I want to say, you know, that this doesn't make moral philosophy, like, writ large irrelevant either, because it's actually first order moral theories like utilitarianism, virtue ethics, deontology. These are not actually affected by the success or the failure of second order moral theories, which second order theories refers to this deeper stuff, this meta-ethical stuff.
Sure.
And so, in other words, like, it doesn't really, one of the fears that people have about this is if moral realism isn't true, then our society will slide into this nihilistic, pit of all these vices and all this horrible stuff. And that's, I don't think that's a valid concern. Okay. I think what we need to be more concerned about is whether or not everyone loses their empathy and their compassion for others. That would be a problem. but if I have compassion and love for other people, that it doesn't matter what I think about the objective status of the moral values, you know, that make that bring bring about or whatever. So that's the first thing. That I'm not convinced of moral realism. This doesn't really help me. These people that were converted, great for them. But until you also have to be convinced that moral values can only exist in an objective sense if God exists. And obviously, like, my whole argument here today is that that's not the case. All the power to those people. But
let's come back to you then, John, but because I think we want to get into this idea of obviously. Corey says, well, I can abide by, you know, certain rules and be able to make moral judgments on the basis of my view that well-being, you know, is something to strive for and everything else. But that doesn't mean I'm committed to having to ground it in some kind of metaphysical reality beyond anything. Lots of people have problems, like Corey does, with the idea of objective moral values and duties. And I'll just repeat again the question that came in on a show that I read out on a show last week. David Holes, who's an atheist, asks, okay, it's been gone over before, but surely experience and history show that moral values aren't set in stone and are relative according to time, place, and culture. For example, in previous centuries, slavery was accepted, torture, capital punishment, forced marriages, scores of other practices now seen as barbaric were allowed. And similarly, other things have changed significantly over the past few decades. And so essentially, there's this moral, you know, zeitgeist. It changes over time. And David says, surely this blows the moral argument for the existence of God right out of the water. Moral values are clearly set by the human culture and community of a given time or place. They just must surely be relative and not God-defined. What am I missing, he says. So what's he missing, as far as you're concerned then, John?
I think actually that does the opposite. I think it affirms moral realism. It affirms our intuitions. Notice how he called those practices of those earlier civilizations barbaric. So
he says,
what does
now
that mean?
Now
we're
seen
less barbaric.
He says now seen progressed? As he says now seen as barbaric. So I guess he's saying they weren't seen as barbaric before. Now we see them as barbaric. We are moral.
So they're
They're
really not barbaric. We've just changed our tastes. I think intuitively and experientially, most of us know that society has probably progressed. We've gotten better. And that kind of that implies, well, how do we know we've gotten better? Implies there's some sort of standard. But I wanted to back up really quick to what Corey just mentioned. Premise two of my argument aside, I think I presented a pretty strong argument to show that if you're going to have moral realism or, you know, objective morality, it sort of requires God. There's a contradiction if you try to incorporate an ought in a universe where there is no ought. I think that contradiction remains, and I'm not sure that Corey has responded to that. So I think you need, in order to make sense of that ought, you have to posit a universe that begins with an ought.
But John, you know, with respect, yes. Like right now, we're just talking about whether there is an ought. And like right now, I'm free to just deny that. And I don't see an ought. So, so then how do you convince me that there's an ought?
Right. What I would say, I would just ask you, why are you skeptical that there is an ought? You kind of, you know, you seem to be a rational person, a kind person. You seem to make, you treat me kindly, you know, we disagree on a lot of things. But why are you doubtful that there's a moral realm? I mean, I would argue that the same faculties that you come to believe that there's an external world are the same sort of faculties that deliver to you that a moral realm exists or that certain things are right or wrong. These sorts of things are experienced immediately. They're properly basic. So my question is to you is if you're skeptical of the moral reality, why aren't you skeptical of these other realities, these other faculties of ours that we can't get outside of and test? We can't prove they're reliable. We're just under the assumption that they're just reliable. I mean, most of us don't believe we're in the matrix right now. There's no way to prove it. So we're just under the assumption that our five senses, our memory, these things are all functioning correctly. So why are you skeptical that your moral sensibility is not functioning, or it's dubious? Why the skepticism there?
Yeah. So the questioner is, his heart is in the right place, but I think he is just sort of confusing moral ontology with moral epistemology. So in other words, like this whole issue with relativism, it doesn't really matter in terms of ontology, right? Because like the fact that people have changed their moral views, it just may mean that they're getting closer and closer to the actual fact of the actual ontology of moral value. Mm-hmm. So that I don't think that's not a good objection, with all due respect to the questioner, to what John is saying. Mm-hmm. And I would sort of staple my response to him on that point, and by just saying that. I mean, basically, John, what you're doing is you're trying to justify your ontology with your epistemology. You're just basically saying that, well, my intuitions are what tell me that something is good or bad. And my position is that's not good enough. And as to whether, like, so you, and then you make an analogy, this is a common analogy here, to the way we rely upon our sense organs to believe there's an external reality. I think the difference is that there's much more discrepancy and incongruence between the moral intuitions and perceptions of people than there is discrepancy and differences between the perceptions of external reality.
So I disagree with that 100%.
Okay, but do you see, John, how this boils down back again to this subjective layer where you were disagreeing now at this point about what's more plausible. Like, what's more plausible is not objective, it's subjective, right? So, like, it seems implausible to you, right, that there are not objective moral values. But it seems implausible to other people that there are objective moral values. And so this is why I find myself in this limbo between – because and what's interesting is that atheists, there are atheist moral realists that make the same sort of justification that you do, in that they rely upon a sort of intuitionism
as their epistemology. If a solipsist was in this room with us, Corey, I mean you could run the same sort of argument. I mean – internal consistency, they could argue for their case. You know, we really can't get outside of our senses, our memory, to prove that solipsism is not true, or that reality, the external world, is real. But do you believe that they're right just because it's possible? I don't understand the skepticism here. No. You know, there's as much discrepancies with our five senses. No two people can agree on what's down the road, or, you know, if you put a yardstick in a cup of water, if you look at it a certain way, it seems bent. I mean, there's a plethora of discrepancies with our five senses. Yet, at the end of the day, we think they're generally reliable, and we operate under that assumption. But it seems morality, you're skeptical.
Imagine if people disagreed about so much in a similar way. About external reality and about what we perceive, as they do about I think part of the problem here is some people think that there's more congruence between moral values and across different cultures and different people than I think there really is. And I think there's some serious discrepancies there. And it's the question here again, I'm not confusing ontology with moral epistemology, because you're using epistemology as your justification. And so if we're using how we know our intuitions as a justification for X, but those same intuitions lead to radically different conclusions about X, then that doesn't – it's similar to like the argument about like religious experience. Like I can't argue against the truth of a particular religion by pointing out that, oh, well, that's just your religious experience. But I can certainly undermine the argument from experience for the truth of religion, by just pointing out that experience isn't it's not universal. There's all these different discrepancies.
We're going to have to start to wind things up, guys. I'm sorry, because time is beating us now. So do you want to just give us a final thought on this, John, as we conclude today's show?
Sure. I would say that again, I agree with Corey. If you believe in the second premise of this argument, that objective moral values and duties exist, I think you're presented with a phenomenon you got to account for. And like I said, and I'm not sure if Corey has addressed it, maybe we can address it off air at some point later. I think there's a contradiction. If you posit that the reality is such that there's no way things ought to be, you can't retain the ought. You have to make sense of it. And I think it makes better sense of a world that begins with an ought. So I think the question comes down to is whether you believe the second premise is true. And I just don't understand the skepticism. You know, if you see something that strikes you as evil, or you know, these things are immediately known to us. We see people behaving in a certain way, and I don't think this requires any further justification any more than our experience of the real world does. In the same reason you can't get outside of your five senses to prove that the real world exists, then if we don't strap that burden on our shoulders, then we shouldn't strap it when it comes to our experience of the moral realm. So theism makes the best sense of it.
The best explanation, as you say in your argument.
Yes.
Corey, any final words? Or just I'm going to have to tie you down to 20 seconds here, but go ahead.
All right. Well, sorry. You know, I'll just summarize. I still don't see any reason to think that God is necessary for morality, because we've already established that that which makes something good isn't contingent on the existence of God. And I just don't think that our intuitions is enough to justify moral realism, because that's still subjectivity. So thanks for having me on the show, John. This has been awesome. And I can't wait to continue it. And our second go around.
Absolutely.
Well, look, guys, it's been great fun having you both on. Thank you. You've taken us on a deep dive into the moral argument today on the show. Really helpful, I think, as well, for those who want to really get their head around this particular argument for God.
And neither one of us drowned. So,
well, I might have. I was just about bobbing above the surface most of the time. So anyway, thanks, guys. And all the very best. And I look forward to seeing some of the post show thoughts about this as we go on.
Yes. Justin, so thanks again. Thank you. And Corey, thank you so much. This is awesome.
Yeah, thanks again, both of you guys. This has been great.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'm afraid we've only a few minutes to get a little bit of your feedback into last week's program, which was very popular. David Smalley, our atheist, and our Christian Frank Turek debating, have atheists stolen reason and logic from God? If you want to get in touch about today's show, though, as ever, email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can find us on social media at unbelievablejb for the Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or leave a thought underneath today's show at the website, where you can listen back to the program from today, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Okay, so to last week's program, really very much a split in opinion about how both sides did, and very much seen as a who won the debate kind of a conversation. And a number of people, including a number of atheists I've seen, saying that they thought Frank won on points, as it were. Others saying, no, they think David did a good job representing atheist side of that argument. So here's some emails from both sides. Adam in Arlington, Texas says the Turek-Smalley debate is one of your best yet. You had two guests who were well-spoken and could go toe-to-toe. However, I think David Smalley, the atheist, won the debate. He exposed Frank's tactics, and by the end of the debate, Frank was trying to accuse David for having the debate go off topic, when he does the same thing himself during the discussion. I think the defining moment was when David corrected Frank's definition of atheism, then used Frank's logic to show how the Bible would not be logical. Hope you have them on again. In similar vein, Tom Rafferty in Charlotte, North Carolina, Frank Turek seems to have a hard time giving up his straw man view of an atheist. No matter how many times David Smalley tried to correct him regarding how most atheists articulate their atheism, I do not accept the claims that there is a God because there's no evidence for one, he continued to misrepresent atheism. In essence, Frank is using an argument from ignorance, a God of the gaps, to make his unfounded claim that logic and reason has to come from God. Here's an interesting one from Graham Robinson, who's also an atheist, who got in touch before the episode aired to say, perhaps you've already recorded Turek versus Smalley and know how things worked out. I fear that pitching someone who thinks loud repetition is an argument against someone with shaky understanding of naturalistic philosophy is going to show neither side of the issue in a positive light. I hope my fears are unfounded. Well, Graham then got back to me, having listened to the programme, saying, it looks like I was wrong. Turek, aside from being a little brash and loud for English taste, seemed to be very fair in his challenges to Smalley's somewhat evasive responses. Well done on handling the debate. Shame my team did not do a better job. And Joel in Moundville, Alabama, says, my frustration levels spiked to the point of me yelling out loud at my computer, ontology, not epistemology. The argument is that materialistic atheists steal from God in justifying their worldview, not in formulating or applying it. Total side note, it might be worth pointing out on the show sometimes that the academic literature rejects this rising notion of atheism as simply a lack of belief. There are a lot of problems with defining atheism that way during rigorous discussion. Three examples. One, it shifts all self-proclaimed agnostics into the atheist category. Second, the system treats God belief as binary. It's either something you have or you don't if you're working with the new terms. They leave no category for maybe. I think most of us would agree that belief isn't always like a light switch, and that something more akin to Richard Dawkins' spectrum of theistic probability is actually a better way of thinking about it. And thirdly, the new term actually voids the word atheism of any real practical meaning. It doesn't take long to find out how exhausting it is interacting with a movement that defines itself in negative terms. Thank you very much, Joel. David says, I couldn't listen to all of the show for the same reason I can no longer listen to dogma debate. David Smalley's inability to grasp, never mind respond to philosophical arguments, he has repeatedly admitted for a few years now that philosophy isn't his strongest subject, yet seemingly refuses to do any homework to improve his ability. I have listened to him with a few too many apologists now when in discussion he cannot even grasp the basis of their argument, planting as evolutionary argument against naturalism, the transcendental argument for God, and discussions on moral philosophy have all flown over his head on many occasions. He never seems to be able to learn from the discussions where the apologist clearly has a greater knowledge and understanding of the topic, which is the most frustrating thing. He just exclaims his ignorance on the topics time and time again. But these are key topics in apologetics, and exclaiming ignorance is okay for a little while. You can't continue to publicly exclaim ignorance on key issues you claim to be a professional debater about and be taken seriously in that sphere. And Jonathan Mitchell, who's an assistant professor at the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at Stephen F. Austin State University, says, it seems to me that Frank is simply positing that one needs to justify use of the laws of logic in order to use them. David's response was, no, atheists disagree on all sorts of matters involving materialism and naturalism. Guess what? Christians disagree on a great many things too, but this misses the point. When atheists, or anyone for that matter, disagree with each other, I would imagine they communicate and debate by making statements. These statements only make sense in the context or framework of an objective set of laws of logic. David suggested the laws of logics were constructs of the human mind, but does he still consider them objective? It doesn't take much experience to find that there are many human minds with different sets of human logic if you allow subjectivity in the matter. Accepting subjective laws of logic is like speaking different languages. An Englishman and Frenchman can discuss all sorts of things in their own language without making any progress towards anything. Frank's point is that there is an objective language, the laws of logic, that everyone seems to accept. If we use such laws, then we must be ready to explain from where or through whom they came. Good show, Justin. You're a top-notch mediator for debates, articulating well what one says and setting up the other. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Jonathan. I will try to do that, and thank you very much for being in touch, everyone, about last week's programme. We'll bring some more of those emails about that debate next week, as well as, I'm sure, some from today's discussion. But in the meantime, thank you very much for being with me for this week's edition of Unbelievable. Coming up next, I'm going to be speaking to N.T. Wright and Pete Gregg on The Profile. So if you're listening here this Saturday afternoon, you'll want to stick around. But whether you're listening online or live this afternoon, you can join me next week for Unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
Appropriately enough, this weekend marks Darwin Day. Well, next week on the programme, we're going to be talking about Darwin's theory of evolution, particularly the neo-Darwinian version of it, and asking, is that theory in crisis? Because there was a special meeting at the Royal Society last year in November in which something happened to evolution, and we're not quite sure what, but two people who think they know what the direction might be join me on the programme next week. It's going to be intelligent design theorist Stephen Meyer and Perry Marshall. So look forward to that programme, same time next week. Until then, have a great week. See you next time.